Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, hi, and welcome. I am your host, Emigan Awardner, and in my nearly 20-year career as a beauty and health writer, I have interviewed a lot of people. Supermodels, entrepreneurs, authors, celebrities, and doctors. And many of these conversations had a real impact on me, and I'd come away feeling inspired, excited, informed, and really empowered. And at the back of my mind, I'd always think, I wish I could just publish the tape so people could really feel that conversation. Well, on this podcast, you get to feel the conversation. I talk with experts, guests, and a few friends who I hope will inspire, inform, and empower you, and maybe also challenge you, whether you're looking for self-help, self-improvement, beauty advice, health insights, business know-how, or just some good old-fashioned life advice and a bit of a laugh. It's all here. Welcome to the show. My guest in this episode of the podcast is philanthropist, environmentalist, model, and actress Lily Cole. Ultimately, our conversation centers around optimism and her new book, Who Cares Wins, Reasons for Optimism in Our Changing World. The book acknowledges that we are living in an age of turmoil, destruction, and uncertainty. If you think about things like global warming, human expansion, the extinction of many species, as well as the divide in wealth and the current political landscape, but that there are, in and amongst all of these things, plenty of reasons for optimism. Lily travelled the world meeting the people who are working on a solution to our biggest challenges and committed to creating a more sustainable and peaceful future. So whether that's an exploration of the impact of fast fashion, the impact of fast food, renewable energy and gender equality, Lily spoke to people including Stella McCartney, Elon Musk, Extinction Rebellion co-founder Professor Gail Bradbrook and many others. When I read Who Cares Wins, I was struck by how thorough Lily's research had been and also how she acts as a really helpful and kind guide to how a lot of these things are interconnected. So if you've ever thought about the positive steps you can take to contribute to helping the planet and your wider community and just feel as though it doesn't take long before you get lost in the weeds about what is and what isn't helpful, Lily really does explain it all. It's a fascinating, fascinating read. In this conversation, we talk about how she tackled such a complicated subject, the conversation she had and the research that shaped her book, why it's so important to remain optimistic even when the information presented to you may look and feel hopeless, and why now more than ever it's so important to be an engaged citizen of planet Earth. The links to everything we discuss are obviously going to be in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this podcast. But please join me in welcoming Lily Cole onto the Emma Gunn Show. Hi, Lily. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
I'm really delighted that this book, which listeners for the benefit, I am showing to Lily, even though she's probably incredibly familiar with it. I'm so grateful for it because I feel as though climate change, environmentalism is something that I sort of
try to take a look at. And every time I do, I come up against a brick wall, or it becomes confusing, or the thing that I thought I learned that would be the good behavior or the thing that would be useful to do is actually not. And it feels like what you've created here is almost like the guide. This is how it all interlinks. This is what's really going on. And so you've done a ton of heavy lifting for us.
It was an awful lot of work. So I appreciate that it feels that way. And I appreciate that you find it helpful, because that was what it was aspiring to do.
Really helpful. And obviously, when I get sent a book, sometimes it comes through with a blurb, and it's called A Radical Guide. And for me, honestly, I felt like I genuinely came away thinking, I feel as though it's really rational. Not that it can't be radical and rational, but it just sort of rhymed and it looked similar on paper. But it just feels like a really rational look at the whole situation. So would you mind, just for the context, just explaining how the book came about and how this, what I'm really curious about is how the exploration started off as a germ of an idea and then took you all around the world speaking to so many people.
Well, firstly, I think I'll make a comment on your radical rational point. I didn't write the radical term. And I think a lot of the ideas it contains, most of them are very rational, although some of them might appear as radical. And I guess that's what's interesting, right, that some of the most reasonable, sensible ideas are still quite hard for politicians and society to move towards. Though that is, I'd argue, shifting. In terms of how I came into it, so I had, as the book kind of follows, I've been doing this work for over 10 years in my own personal capacity, through kind of trying to understand how our different social environmental challenges manifest and how I could help in my own small way understand them and potentially, you know, be part of solutions rather than problems. And I started that work through fashion and looking at the companies I was working with and the supply chains of companies I was working with, alongside working with some charities. And then I went on to found some of my own companies, first in fashion and then in technology, which then weirdly took me into technology and learning a lot more about technology. And all the while learning more and more about the environment and feeling for me personally like that was the kind of biggest issue that we needed to deal with. Although believing and seeing it as intersecting with almost every other social issue we also have to deal with. So anyway, I was on that journey. And then one of the projects that I worked on, which is a platform called Impossible, which I write about in the book, which began as a technology platform trying to create more community and encouraging kind of small acts of kindness between people. I'd spent a few years working on that. And Penguin, the publisher, contacted me and asked me if I would write specifically about that idea and that project and why I kind of, you know, spent so much energy trying to do it. And so I said yes, and I started writing that version of the book, which then became a chapter in the book, because I felt like it's more in a whole book, that idea. Partially because there are already very good books written about the gift economy. So I felt like I didn't need to rewrite stuff that already existed. And also because I felt like it fitted into a wider narrative I was interested in, which was all the different ways we can think about positive action and social change, whether that's kind of social business or protest or conscious consumerism or more kind of like philosophical arguments. So I ended up re-pitching to Penguin, hey, how about I write kind of reasons for optimism and cover a wider selection of ideas, which they loved. And I didn't really think through quite how much more extra work I was giving myself. But once I started, I was on that thread. And so I ended up, yeah, trying to cover many different reasons for optimism.
But I do feel the optimism side of things is incredibly useful. And that's because if you just read the veneer of the headlines, it would be very difficult to feel optimistic about any of the things that you dig into in the book. I mean, I have listened to David Wallace Wells talk about climate change, and he's quite pragmatic, but he's quite realistic about what the future is going to hold. And you can just sort of think, oh, well, and it could lead you to be apathetic even perhaps, and just think, well, it's done now, isn't it? But at every point in the book, there is a reason to cling to hope and the reason to move forward positively and with optimism. And I was curious about when that nugget was born. Have you always just had that mindset of, I won't take no for an answer, I will always find the chink in the armor or the little beam of light that is potentially great?
I mean, interestingly, I was sent David Wallace Wells's book, because it was also published by Penguin, when I was in the middle of writing mine, and I started it and I just put it down. I was just like, yeah, far too depressing and realistic for me to look at. And then I came back to it when I was very close to finishing mine, and it's brilliantly written. But yeah, it does take a much kind of harsher view of the situation, which I also think is necessary. I think that we need the kind of combination of messages that come out. In terms of why I've framed mine in a more positive, optimistic way, is not because I doubt for a second the science that David Wallace Wells focuses on. I think when you look at the scientific picture and you look at the threats, the environmental threats that we have already actually emerging around the world, but certainly, you know, manifesting in the near future, it is a terrifying picture. And actually, I put some of that scientific data in the appendix at the end for anyone who's not convinced that we do have a big problem. They can go to a very unoptimistic part of the book in the appendix and see the data. That said, for me, the more interesting question and the one I focused on is, okay, if you accept that picture, then how do you respond? And certainly apathy is not going to be helpful and is not going to fix the problem. And I actually think that pessimism is not necessarily going to help fix the problem, because that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? That if we believe that we're fucked, for want of a better word, then we might take actions that will manifest a more fucked up situation to come along. So instead, I'm more interested in actually, and I do believe that right now, we still have the capacity to change things. You know, we are losing species. The temperature is going up. These are very real things. Pollution levels are higher. Air pollution is higher. But we still have a habitable planet. And we still do have lots of biodiversity. And there's still a lot to protect. And so we haven't reached a point at which we should give up. In fact, we're at a point where we have the opportunity to change our behavior, to protect what exists, and to kind of course out a different next chapter for humanity. And if you look at what humanity has achieved in the past, I think we've achieved extraordinary things and made extraordinary progress. And so I have a lot of faith that humanity can rise to this challenge if we want to. And yes, that will involve very clever scientists and very amazing technologists, perhaps, and bold and brave politicians. But it also really involves all of us, all of the individuals who are making choices, who are creating the kind of collective psychology that creates the world we are in. And so I think the book is speaking more to us as individuals and the role that we might want to play in the future we're creating. I never give up, which is probably one of my failures or flaws as a person. But I do always tend to try and persevere with things to the bitter end.
Yes, I must admit, I'm the same. If someone tells me no, I'm like, In a good way, I hasten to add, not like Veruca Salt.
Like a red flag, right? It's like, you think I can't? Okay, let me show you. I'll try my best.
Exactly. I'll prove you wrong. But you mentioned then something about the science, which is really interesting, because after David Wallace Wells, the book came out and he did a load of podcasts and what have you, I noticed definitely the narrative change in conversations about global warming and climate change, to say we just need someone to come up with the science. And I...
What do you mean? People, who said that?
It was sort of this thing, what do they call it, chatter of people saying, well, there's not much we can do. We need someone like Elon to just develop a machine that'll just suck out all the carbon dioxide. And then I just thought, well, that's a big gamble. Yeah. You know, this isn't Armageddon and Bruce Willis isn't up on the asteroid. Like, we need to be a bit more proactive.
I mean, there's actually a beautiful quote from David Wallace Wells' book that I quote in mine, when, because I interviewed Elon Musk, where David Wallace Wells, maybe slightly misquote him, but he says, Elon Musk is a species, isn't a person, he's a species survival strategy. Which is the idea, right? That like I mean, not everyone, but there are people, if not banking on him, banking on green technology to save the day. And as I put in the book, that's a very dangerous gamble to make. It's not to say that technology won't play a principal part in trying to evolve our systems into better versions of themselves, but assuming that technology, which largely got us into a lot of this mess, is going to get us cleanly out, and then not taking other action and not looking at other aspects of the problem, I think would be a very dangerous, dangerous gamble.
Yes. And I know that, for example, I've had people on this podcast before, and we've talked about fast fashion and sustainability. And I mean, today we are recording this during lockdown, but today in London is the first day that non-essential shops are open. And it's been all over the news that people are queuing outside clothing shops. And I must admit, it just feels like the message hasn't sort of filtered through necessarily, that those choices aren't necessarily great. Like, fast fashion isn't necessarily a good choice to be making. And to actually contribute and to be positive and to have an impact on the future, we do have to be making conscious decisions about where we are spending our money, where we are not, who we are supporting and who we're not. And I wonder if in the research, when you were doing the research for this book, if you feel like that shift is going to gather more momentum, because personally, I really hope that it does.
I mean, I've certainly seen it in my own experience gather a huge amount of momentum. So I started working in the kind of sustainable fashion space in my teens, so like over 15, 16 years ago. And it, with that point in time, was quite like niche and anti-fashion, and kind of probably had an image of being quite like ugly, crunchy clothes. And now, I mean, I did a talk last week with American Vogue, who was, you know, the forefront of at least trying to have that conversation about what sustainability looks like in fashion, i.e. it's very in vogue. And there are more and more small brands developing more sustainable visions of fashion. There are big brands making big pledges. There are new types of platforms that exist that think about how new business models, how people can consume differently, whether that's buying secondhand vintage clothes or renting clothes or mending clothes. I still don't think it's as mainstream as it needs to be. And I think there's a long way to go in cleaning fashion, like all industries, up. But it's certainly going in the right direction. So that gives me a lot of optimism. In terms of analyzing the impact of this lockdown and if it's going to make people change their behavior, I think it's probably too early to say. You know, yes, there might be people queuing outside shops today, but we don't actually know the data on how many people, you know, so some people want to buy clothes or need to buy clothes, but we don't really have any data yet to show that there might be a significant number of people who are buying less or are thinking about consuming differently. So I think the jury's still out, and I'm hoping that this pause, the great pause, as people call it, might help encourage some people to reflect a bit more on these choices.
I haven't heard it called that yet. Great pause.
Yeah.
It's quite nice. Yeah. You also address really early on in the book something that I think is really important to say, actually. Sustainability, living a green lifestyle, making sustainable choices, does get dismissed, and I've even seen it happen at talks that I've been to, as something, it's just something that rich folk can do. Mm-hmm. And you make a really great point in the book that actually the majority of emissions are created by that bracket of wealthy, therefore they should be the ones living that way. And if it costs and they can afford to do it, then actually that doesn't mean that they won't be having any impact.
Yeah, it's a very complicated area that I try and address a few times in the book, firstly up front, as you mentioned, and then later on when I look at, like, there's a chapter where I look at like slow growth and fast growth and this idea of whether the kind of the tensions in the environmental debate around whether everyone needs to buy less and be a bit poorer in a way, especially rich people, to make the environment safer, versus a school of thought that thinks that as we develop, as countries get richer and people get richer, then they can afford to care more, buy better, push for better policies, innovate technologically. And the flip narrative is true. When you look at the data, for sure, most emissions are caused by wealthy individuals and wealthy countries. It tends to be the more money you have, the bigger your footprint. Yet, ironically, it also then allows potentially for people to buy into expensive new technology that might be better for the environment, but costs more, whether that's electric cars or organic food or sustainable fashion sometimes. And so there is a kind of inherent paradox there. The area I think is worth thinking about and looking at is just basically buying less and buying secondhand and DIY and growing your own, all these types of movements in the kind of voluntary simplicity space, which make sustainability accessible to everyone, because there are actually cheaper ways of living and cheaper ways of being that are less impactful. Meanwhile, I think there's also an interesting conversation around what the cost of things really is, and the fact that fast fashion and disposable materialism is based on a really kind of false premise that things can be made that cheaply and not be really harmful to the environment and to the people also who are involved in making stuff. And I think that we've been very misguided in a way in the last few decades by what the cost of things really are. You know, even well-meaning friends of mine struggle to accept the price sometimes of sustainable fashion because they think it's very, some pieces are very expensive. But then when you break it down to them and you're like, look, you're paying somebody to hand make that in the UK, for example, using organic cotton, and then you add taxes, and then you add, and that's just the true cost of something. It's very hard to get your head around because we're used to paying prices that reflect paying very low wages in China or Bangladesh or, you know, other countries, often factory made, and usually not accounting for the cost of pollution and damage that's caused in the making of things. And these are all more political problems that it's, I think, unfair to put on the consumer to deal with. And that's where politics needs to play a role in essentially regulating capitalism better so that it's not so possible to make damaging products. Sorry, that was a very confusing, probably long answer to your question.
No, I enjoyed it very much. What was your experience when you began to tackle it from the when you started to tackle the politics of it in terms of speaking to people who are either in elected positions or in the position to be able to implement changes? Did you ever come up against, did it feel different?
In a funny way, it doesn't, because they're ultimately humans, right? Just like us all, and full of, like, you know, ideals and contradictions and also pressures. I sometimes feel very frustrated, like most people, at politicians, that they're not doing what you'd hope they would do. Other times I actually feel quite I don't know if sympathetic is the right word, like sorry for them, because I think a lot of politicians have to deal with very difficult, very difficult existing contradictions in their reality, i.e. I interviewed the advisor to President Macron who was talking about the yellow vest riots that they'd had in France when they tried to implement a kind of tax on carbon around fuel usage. And he admitted the way that the tax was put into place was not ideal, and it kind of made individuals and poorer communities suffer, and it needed to be redesigned. So there was obviously a design issue. But what they'd been trying to do is to put environmental legislation in place, in part in response to the fact that there is a rising movement asking for more environmental legislation. And you realize that it's very hard when you have these competing protest movements and these competing desires from the public, and you've got to deal with the media as well. So I don't think politicians' jobs are easy. I wish our democratic systems were more transparent, and then there would be less and more representative, and then we'd be probably blaming politicians less because we'd feel more empowered ourselves. And I look at that a bit in the book around direct democracy and participatory democracy and ways that you can try and evolve that system that hasn't really evolved for a few hundred years properly to help try and redress that a bit.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's working within a system that is really quite old. And some of the things that are blocking what needs to happen now are so outdated. Mm-hmm. To the point where recently, I mean, it's been such an intense time. Recently, I just decided, I was Googling, what do you have to do to become an MP?
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah. Are you going to do it?
Well, I don't know, but I just thought, for me personally, I look at the political structure and I think, well, I don't really see anyone there necessarily representing me. And it feels as though clearly there's a lot of people with strong opinions who aren't being represented. So surely one of the most important things we could do is get people who want to make a difference into the political system.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might be a bit idealistic.
Go for it. I think, yeah, why not? Someone's got to do that job. I think it was really interesting. There was a good Netflix documentary about how Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, might be slightly mispronouncing her name, AOC as she's better known in the US,
How
she came to power. Did you see that?
I haven't yet.
I can't remember the name. The House Must Be Broke or something. If you just Google her name, yeah, maybe you'd find it. And it was really interesting because basically she had been approached. Her brother apparently had put her forward to this organization in the US. There's two. One's called Brand New Congress and one's called Justice for Democrats. And their sole purpose is to try and get kind of alternative political candidates up that promise from the beginning to not take any corporate money, i.e. they're trying to get lobbying out of the political system. And her brother had apparently put her forward. She was famously like a waitress, Puerto Rican waitress in the Bronx previously, but obviously very politically active and opinionated and smart. And she'd managed to rise to power, I think at the age of 29, she was elected. So that was quite interesting to think about how you if lobbying, which also Macron's advisor recognizes being one of the biggest kind of barriers to progress, if lobbying is so endemic to the political system, then how do you think of smart ways to innovate on that? And I thought that was quite a clever way to not be, you know, like not to be breaking the system down, but to be using the system and infiltrating it in a positive way for change.
I mean, slightly removed from the book, but obviously there was a heck of a lot of research that went into this. And I'm just wondering, if somebody's listening to this and they definitely feel motivated right now, given everything that's going on in the world, to be more engaged, do you have any, I think tips sort of minimizes it a little bit, but do you have any advice of where and how to begin?
I mean, it sounds a bit pathetic, but I think just caring in the first instance is massive, like deciding to care and deciding to not just like disengage is probably the most important step, because then that will take you on a journey of learning. I'd say be open-minded, because the information is always changing, even though that's confusing and people have very different opinions. And that's a bit of the kind of spirit of the book, is listening to different opinions and being open-minded to the fact that this is very complicated territory and we're all learning and we need to listen to each other to try and find the right way through. In terms of my own personal opinions today of what I think are the simplest actions that have an impact environmentally, caveating that this may change in 10 years time, but I think certainly reducing the amount of animal products we eat and use is one of the biggest, easiest wins, and there's plenty of papers and data that makes that point quite clearly, partially because has one of the biggest impacts, animal agriculture, particularly obviously industrialized factory farming of animals. Mm-hmm. The amount we're consuming is insane. The amount of land that uses is disproportionate to how much land you use for growing vegetables, for example, or grains. It's considered either the first or the second biggest contributor to global greenhouse gas emissions, depending on the way you do the metrics, but even if it's only second, I mean, that's still massive. And it's the simplest thing that people can do, right? It's not complicated. It's just changing your eating habits. Maybe hard psychologically or culturally, but it's not going to take the time that it takes to change bank or change pension or change car or change energy grid. All of which, by the way, are great things to do. But if you're looking for the easiest one, just like reduce the amount of animals you're eating and try and support good farmers, I'd say it was probably the simplest. Generally, I think just consuming less is also one of the best things to do. You know, it seems quite hard, especially in our culture where we're like bombarded by adverts and messages that constantly tell us we need to buy more and do more and be more and get more. But trying to resist that, and, you know, I'm not saying don't buy at all. I personally still love buying things and having things, but it's almost like loving things more, you know, buying more mindfully and carefully, and then looking after the things that you have. I think that's also a big win.
It comes back again to caring a little bit, doesn't it? It's like when you, I mean, I had this experience not long ago and I felt so embarrassed. I had bought something and I really sort of coveted it for a while, put it in my wardrobe, and then went back a couple of months later and went, what's that? And completely forgotten that I bought it. And I thought, oh, this is, you're just a greedy consumer.
Yeah.
Have a word with you.
I look at quite a lot in the end of the book is developing a relationship with nature. There's loads of data and research that shows that having time in nature, having a relationship with nature, is really good for mental health. It makes you happier. So it feels like a double win. You know, it's, for me personally, been a big part of my journey with environmentalism, is that I went from being a city girl who grew up in London, who had absolutely no interest or no respect for nature. I thought it was the most boring thing possible, really, to building this relationship where now it's like, it's my version of religion, you know, that like listening to the birds and, you know, just spending time immersed in nature and seeing wildlife brings a real magic to my life. And so I would encourage, if people are interested in being more environmental, that aspect of it can make it really, really enjoyable and not feel like a sacrifice, actually feel like a path that could make you more happy and life more rewarding.
Well, you'll also, I think, it, I'm the same as you, city girl, well, born in the countryside, but lived in the city for a long time. I now have to, I moved to have a park right next to my house for basically for hearing the birds, for seeing greenery. I love walking into the park and just looking at the trees because they just look majestic. And I guess if you are near that or connected to that in some way, then the decisions will obviously become more naturally because you'll have an appreciation for something.
Yeah, and it's also, it's like a relationship, right? Like if you begin to love the natural world, then you want to protect it, right? And it's, there's a side to environmentalism that's of course self-interested, right? First and foremost, the planet will be fine. Even, you know, the worst case scenario is probably that humanity wipes itself out and probably wipes out lots of other species, but life will continue. You know, there's been at least 5 other mass extinctions in the past and life bounced back. So kind of, it is in a way a selfish game, you know, that we're trying to protect ourselves. That said, we are also, you're also, if you have a relationship with the species around you and the plant life and the animals, you also have something that you're trying to look after. Yeah, I guess it does come back to caring again.
You do also quite early on reference the 6th extinction, and I have my Invisalign thingies on, so I'm sorry if I tripped over that. But and I did think, oh. And then is that exactly as you say, but we might be the first ones to actually reverse it or at least avoid it for a substantial amount of time.
Yeah. It's really interesting when you go into like proper history, you know, like I studied the version of history that probably most people do in schools, which is like the last few thousand years. But when you start going really big picture and you look at like millions of years, because obviously the planet's been around, I think it's 4.5 billion years, they think the planet's been around. It's kind of extraordinary the amount that the planet has changed and the different ecosystems and civilizations of species that have lived and then not lived. If we do manage to, we're in a very like weird, unique position as far as we can tell, that we're the first species that is accelerating the pace of change on this planet so prolifically that we are changing the ecosystem at a rate that's historically never happened before, and therefore creating a destabilization that threatens our own existence. But we're also weirdly the first species like cognizant of that change and documenting it and writing about it and painting about it and singing about it and, you know, like turning it into art and conversation. And so there's a chance that we could consciously avoid, you know, and change that narrative, which would be pretty awesome. And it's probably a reason worth fighting for humanity, right? That we are the first species that cognizant.
It's reminding me, It's reminding me of a conversation I had with someone a little while ago, and they were talking about if you want to make significant change, you almost have to think, and bear with this analogy, because we're not talking about the iceberg, but it's almost like you have to think of whatever you're on as the Titanic, and you have to know that you can turn that wheel even just a little bit, but it'll take ages before you might.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Feel your course change. Because it's like moving a big, massive ship, whatever it might be. And that feels a little bit where we are at the moment. Like everything is just hurtling, and we seem to be going, if you follow the press, we're hurtling towards extinction and disaster and martial law and all these really terrifying things that just make you want to stay in bed. But you can take the wheel, you can make a little change, and it's not that you're going to feel it immediately, but it will be felt. And I wonder whether that was something that kept coming back in the optimism mindset of, just because not everybody's doing it doesn't mean that a minority of people doing it isn't going to have a massive impact.
Well, yeah, and somebody was asking me earlier, well, how do you stay optimistic when it's still predominantly white men running the world? And we're kind of like, I think it was a white man asking me, but this kind of white imperialist kind of supremacy that has existed is still here. And so that must be a dent in your optimism. And I was like, well, not really, because yes, we're still living for sure in the kind of remnants of that structure that's been the main structure for a few thousand years. And in many ways, the kind of colonial paradigm still exists. And there is a lot more work to do, as we've, you know, clearly been seeing in recent weeks with the rise kind of in the BLM movement again. But I'm optimistic because if you look at history in a wide context of a few hundred years, we've made so much progress. And so we feel we're going on the right track. And yes, we're going slower than many of us want to go. You know, the utopia to which we're sailing, we're not there yet, and we've still got a way to go. But if you look over the last few hundred years at what we've achieved in terms of, you know, the emancipation of women, the abolishment of slavery, the increasing gain of rights for minority communities, the decriminalization of homosexuality in most countries, animal rights growing. You know, so many different rights you could look at and gains you could look at to realize that actually we're going in a positive direction. And so even though we've got much further to go, we can be hopeful that if we keep pushing in that direction, and we may have ups and downs and kind of moments of, you know, regression briefly, but it seems like, as Dr. King famously said, the moral arc of history points towards justice, just is a long one.
It's interesting. It is about taking a step back and almost looking at it from above, which feels like what you... Well, actually, the book, I feel like the book presents that, but surely the writing of the book and traveling around the world and speaking to these people and understanding these things that are happening and doing all your research must have meant that you were in it for a very long time. And I have always said, for example, and it's not the same thing, but whenever I've done interviews with people, I always say, well, I research them and I wear them like a second skin. Which is a bit weird, but it stuck. And I wondered, once you had done all of this research, once you had gathered all of this information and were living some of it as well, how you were able to compartmentalize and present it in a useful way. Because it is, as I said earlier, it's really rationally presented, and it's very, I don't feel panic in there. Whereas I think at times you may have felt sort of panic and anxiety about some of the things that you had come across.
Yeah, certainly. And I definitely, there were times where I was writing it that I felt very pessimistic, because I was, it's easy to feel optimistic and you switch your mind off and you don't focus on the problems. And I do encourage, I think, reading less news for that reason in general. But yeah, when I was reading all of the scientific papers and the data and meeting climate scientists, it can feel really overwhelming. But I do hold on to the spirit that there are still so many people trying to make things better, and that we still have time, and therefore it's worth focusing on the solutions, not focusing so much on the areas of lack.
Was there a particular section or a particular period during the research that affected you the most?
I mean, it's also my lived experience, right? Like, a lot of the things I'm writing about and some of the trips I write about, I didn't do for the book. I was doing before I wrote the book. I'd say that one of the ones that I've probably struggled with the most and grappled with the most is this question of, like, can we evolve capitalism into a better version of itself? I have spent a lot of my energy and time working in the business sector and founding businesses, not because I have any desire at all to be a business person or to make money from that world. It's more because I saw business as a kind of powerful instrument to affect change, and I wanted to see if we could do it, you know, do it better and what that would look like. And I think for me, that's been sometimes really disheartening, because a lot of business doesn't feel like it cares at all. And it actually feels really hard to run a business in a kind of mindful, ethical, responsible way when you're working in a landscape where many other businesses don't operate in that way, and you have to compete with them price-wise, you know, and otherwise. And so then that makes me feel very disillusioned about the idea that we can evolve capitalism. And I think that's probably just an unsolved question in my head, whether we can evolve that system as much as we need to. The reason I'd like to evolve that system is because, what's the alternative? The alternative is like some kind of revolution that changes the system entirely. And if you look at history, revolutions have always been pretty awful. Like, they've usually been really violent, and often the systems that come in place afterwards are just as bad, if not worse. So yeah, I quite like the idea of improving the systems we have rather than just rejecting them outright. But that has been probably like my own internal struggle. And that struggle probably manifests itself in the book as I explore kind of ways people are trying to evolve the system, and then alternative systems altogether, i.e. like, what do Indigenous cultures do? What can we learn from Indigenous cultures about completely different social arrangements and ways of being and interacting?
Because it isn't a level playing field, is it? You can go into business with the best of intentions and try to, you know, fix it from within, but it isn't a level playing field, because the very nature of your mission statement, of your ethics, all of those things are at odds with what looks like, or what equals success for the traditional business model and business practice.
Yeah, and you're having to compete with, as I said, companies that produce things without a care, you know, without putting so much care into it at really cheap prices. And the consumer doesn't really understand that difference. And I mean, it's just complex. There's been a huge movement in the social business sector that I find really inspiring, whether it's Yunus Social Business, which is Professor Muhammad Yunus's concept of social business. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for microfinance. Or the benefit corporation movement, the B Corp movement that's becoming quite popular, or things like CICs and cooperatives, or even the fact that some of the massivest companies in the world, it's not even a real word, some of the biggest companies in the world, like Apple and JP Morgan, all got together last year and committed to make their businesses not just about shareholder primacy, but also about kind of social impact and community. Now, that was just words, and whether we see a kind of legal shift and a regulatory shift that then reflects that is a different question. But even the fact that they put that signal out and made that kind of a public statement just shows the direction that the business is moving towards. So at the same time as feeling quite disillusioned, I do feel hopeful too.
Yes, well, hope is where it's at. Now, I'm also interested about, I mean, I know we've touched on it in terms of industrial farming, but there is a stat in the book that I now unhelpfully cannot get my eyes on, but it is something about the amount of animals farmed every, I want to say it's every month, it's something like a billion animals. I knew you were going to say it was less than a month. Now I'm very sad. Yeah. And then I sort of scratched my head and thought,
that's how many we kill, not how many we farm. Because obviously we farm a lot more. It's a billion are killed a week.
Yeah. For food.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet there are, what, 7-something, just under 8 billion people on the planet?
Yeah, which probably makes sense when you think about it, because probably a lot of people are eating, you know, a seventh of an animal a week or a fifth of an animal a week, you know, put together.
I find it incredibly shocking. And industrial farming just seems horrible, horrible, horrible. And I just wish there was another way. I don't know if you noticed this.
P.S. by the way, sorry, you mentioned that, like, the mainstream conversation that's not happening right now in response to COVID is the fact that industrial farming of animals is what is causing all contemporary diseases, like major contemporary diseases for humans. Many of them have come from animal agriculture, whether it's HIV, I read measles too, COVID for sure, SARS. And so at some point, obviously, mad cow disease. And at first, there was a kind of political narrative around blaming China and the way that China consume animals. But the same is true of how we manage animals in industrial scale farming patterns in the West as well. And there are many scientific warnings that have long existed about the threats that causes to human health. So I hope at some point we realize that it's not just an animal rights conversation, it's also a human rights conversation about how this type of farming is ultimately damaging to us.
I hadn't even thought about that, but you're absolutely right. At the beginning, it was there was lots of footage of wet markets, but now that you're saying it, it also, they look exactly like a lot of the industrial farm sort of activist footage that I've seen taken when people have broken in. There is no difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is probably why it's not in the mainstream conversation, because it's a conversation that many people are not willing to have. I mean, I'm personally I'm not fully vegan. I try and be as kind of, I call myself vegan. I just eat this kind of small amount of animal products and fish occasionally. And I'm not a kind of hardcore vegan in the sense that I think that's what the world should be. I actually really respect some versions of eating meat, and I respect people's choice or desire to eat meat. But I certainly don't respect the way in which we rear animals, the scale in which we do, and the amount we think we can consume.
I don't know if you experienced this, but at the beginning of lockdown in the UK, and I think around the world, access or getting your regular weekly grocery shop became a little harder than it has previously been. And I remember going to the shops for the first time and realizing that they had obviously changed their distribution or who they were getting their fresh stock from, because it was the first time in years I'd seen a knobbly lemon.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And actually suddenly realizing it, taking that period and seeing knobbly, imperfect fruit, to realize how homogenized it had all been, and how, and actually it just made me think, I never want to buy perfect fruit again.
Yeah. I mean, there was actually a whole ugly fruit movement that I think started in France, Inglorious Fruits and Vegetables, for that reason. And food waste is one of the biggest contributors to the problem. There's a huge amount of food waste. Something like, I read 20 to 50% of food doesn't actually ever make it to a plate, just because of the waste in the supply chain, the fact that it's not perfect. And then, of course, a lot of people throw out food that they buy and don't compost it, and then that creates methane in landfill. So food waste is a huge problem. And yeah, not the only part of that solution, but one of the solutions is embracing ugly, weird shaped fruit and vegetables.
The knobbly lemon was delicious. What can I tell you?
Yeah, I think it's quite fun to have weird shaped stuff. It makes me feel better.
And I also wanted to ask you as well about the impact of perfectionism. And I don't mean perfectionism in the way that, you know, you probably attacked your book and making sure it was perfect. I mean, in the sense of buying perfect. And you talked about repairing clothes and buying secondhand. And it really came, it really affected me recently. I went to go and see a friend who's just moved house, and it's a proper doer-upper. And she's having somewhat of a battle in her head about whether she's done the right thing. And we ended up coming round to the fact that our parents' generation, that was just what happened. Nobody walked into these perfect homes, you know, MTV crib style homes in the 70s and 60s. You went in, there was some god awful wallpaper and some primary color paint somewhere. And bit by bit, room by room, over a pretty prolonged period of time, you made that house your own. But somewhere along the line, there's this idea of you've got to move into somewhere and it's got to be perfect immediately. And I wonder whether, I mean, you can think about that with wardrobes, you can think about that with perfect fruit, whether that actually, that buying this idea of perfect and just for you is actually a really negative, is actually a really big problem.
That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it on those terms before, but I like it. I like your thinking. I agree. It's probably a consequence of, as well, of social media, right? And this idea that many of us are like curating our lives and comparing our lives, and that feeds this idea, right? The perfect wardrobe or the perfect backdrop or the perfect, yeah. I mean, I think it's great to take pride in one's house and one's things. I personally really love interior design and curating spaces and making something feel at home. I'm reading a book right now by my friend Fanny Singer, whose mother actually I interviewed in my book, Alice Waters, who's a kind of amazing legend in the food world of slow food movement. And she describes how her mother, Alice, kind of makes any environment homely. Like, she'll go into an Airbnb and just hide the ugly things in a cupboard and put a like sheet around the light to soften it, put some flowers up. You know, I think that there are like lo-fi ways to create a homeliness in spaces that can be really beautiful. I personally really like minimalism in spaces, but I agree, the idea of like perfection and trying to create a kind of perfect reality is probably problematic, especially if you're doing it to impress other people. You know, if you're not doing it for your own inner sense of peace and joy, but rather to like show off to people when they come to visit, that's probably a little bit off.
I always come back to the example of, I didn't know that you could have a cinema room in your house until I watched MTV Cribs.
Okay.
And now there are many very big houses that on spec, like, yeah, of course it's got a cinema room, of course, why wouldn't it? And that kind of sort of greediness of, obviously if you can afford it, I'm not saying that you shouldn't have it. It's just that I think we've seen lots of very wealthy perfection via our TV screens, and it's drawn, before social media, it's drawn that comparison between what we then live with.
And going back to your earlier question, something that I've struggled with and still feel guilty about, and I write about in the book, is that there's this kind of Western vision of sustainability that would have us, you know, have probably a beautiful house that's solar paneled and a fancy electric car parked in the driveway. And our organic vegetables that we can buy, you know, like there's that vision, right? I'm not saying that different parts of that vision aren't really great aspirations, but the house, and I'm thinking particularly of California, which is probably the beacon of that movement. The houses are usually pretty big, and there might be two electric cars in the driveway. And then you go somewhere like Mozambique. And I say this because I went to Mozambique just before I was in California for this book doing the interviews. And Mozambique is indicative of many other places in the world. But a country like that, where people are living in very, very, very simple mud huts that they've hand-built themselves, that certainly don't have wallpaper, certainly don't have cinema rooms, you know, certainly don't have cars, did, I find, interestingly, have solar panels usually propped outside as the way to charge their cell phones, whatever electronic lights or devices they were using. But this idea of involuntary simplicity and the reality that we exist in a world where there is such extreme inequality between different countries, that suddenly makes the kind of Western vision of sustainability feel incredibly false, and a bit of a kind of naive illusion. So that's one of the kind of internal contradictions I think about as somebody who has an electric car and certainly, you know, doesn't live in a mud hut.
But I think we're all doing what we can do based on our resources, or we're trying. I think I know listeners to this podcast are engaged and interested in this kind of topic and are looking all the while to make changes. And I mean, for example, my background way back is that I started off as a beauty journalist, and the amount of conversations I have with people who won't support a brand because they haven't changed their packaging to a sustainable packaging, mm-hmm. or will really say, I really want to support that brand, but I can't because I know they do this. So people are, so I know what you mean. It's not Mozambique.
Yeah. And I don't try and like make it simple, I think, in my analysis. For example, the fact that I found loads of solar panels in Mozambique, those solar panels wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Western innovation, you know, pushing for the development of solar panels. So there's an argument that you need that development in order for it to manifest in different communities around the world. I'm not saying it's simple or that we should feel guilty or we should all live in mud huts. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that we should maybe just consider what sustainability really means, how much we really need, and also what we're comparing our reality, who we're comparing our reality to. Because it's one thing if you're comparing your perfect house to your neighbor's perfect house or Kim Kardashian's perfect house on Instagram or whatever. And it's important maybe to remember the many, many, many other houses and ways of living that exist in the planet, so we keep perspective on how lucky we actually are and how affluent in many ways our societies are.
That's a really good point, actually. How did you maintain a helpful perspective doing all of this and tackling all sorts of things, from industrial farming to understanding technology and all of these different things? Was there a central question or anything that you kept coming back to that allowed you to process everything?
I don't know that I have a good perspective. I try and keep perspective, but it's easy to lose it in life. I don't know. I think I just looked at one issue at a time. And in each issue, I looked at all the competing arguments and tried to speak to people who I really respected, who often represented alternative positions on the debate, and tried to be open-minded to all of their ideas and understandings of reality, and to try and map them together so I could work out how I felt, and hopefully allow the space for the reader then to also do the same process of making their own choices and decisions when given different perspectives.
I did wonder if your writing room, or wherever it was that you wrote the book, I did wonder whether it was a little bit like a police investigation with a wall of pictures and string connecting this to that.
No, I think just a lot of copy paste and stuff around.
Minority Report, this file over to there. Right. Now, before I let you go, I am going to just ask you, you did interview so, so many people. And I wondered, and you've mentioned Elon, he might not have been the most interesting, but was there anything, because I often find this when I chat to people, there'll be a nugget sometimes that just stays with you for ages afterwards. And it's sort of, It actually never leaves you. And I wondered, in all of the interviews you did, if there was anything that was so powerful and impactful on you that is just now part of your DNA, something that was said or just a perspective that really opened your eyes.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of specific words, but I'll mention some people who really stay with me in my thoughts. Mark Boyle stays with me all the time. I mentioned him at the end of part two. As a kind of antidote to a whole section on green technology and why green technology is so great and is going to kind of save the world. He's the total antidote to that argues that actually we need much less technology and that technology is an inherent part of the problem. And he's chosen an incredibly simple life because that, he says, not only makes him genuinely much happier and fulfilled, but it also feels like the most kind of sensitive way he can exist with the environment. And I don't think I have the courage to live like he lives, nor do I think it's necessarily the best use of my myself, because I think it's not pragmatic that like everyone's going to do that. I think there's a truth to what he not only says but does that stays with me. Alice Waters stays with me, who I just mentioned, who talks about her relationship to food and to the environment feels very philosophical, and it's almost about like just engaging with the world intimately around us and enjoying everything more, enjoying the food we eat, respecting a tomato and that it comes in the right moment, and not eating quickly on the move in your car. It's just a kind of attitude shift that she focuses on food, but you could apply to everything, whether that's fashion or electronics, etc. Farhana Yamin, who I interviewed, who's a climate, she started off as a climate lawyer, and she wrote a lot of the IPCC reports, spent decades of her life doing that work, and then kind of fundamentally gave up and felt like it wasn't going anywhere because basically those governments were ignoring it, and we were continuing to increase emissions and head on this like deadly path, even though all of these legal agreements have been made, like, you know, the Kyoto Protocol or Copenhagen, trying to limit and restrict that. And then so she became an activist and got arrested a year ago now, maybe just over, with the Extinction Rebellion. And when I interviewed her, it just made me cry. And every time I re-listened to her interview, it made me cry again and again and again, because the idea that somebody would feel so desperate, like they would threaten, and somebody really rational and intelligent and thoughtful and peaceful would threaten their liberty and risk going to prison again and again and again because she feels so desperate about the situation, really spoke to me. Earlier in the year, I was in, I went to Davos with climate scientists and meeting the climate scientists there, and also meeting the strikers. So Greta Thunberg went and did, with a group of different youth strikers from around the world, did a climate strike. Again, brought me to tears, because this idea that teenagers were so desperate that they're trying to get the adult world to listen to the scientists was just so surreal, you know, because it puts in very stark terms how surreal our situation has become. And then finally, I'd mention Putani Yawanawa, who's a female leader of the Yawanawa tribe from the Amazon, who's just probably one of my heroes. I think she's an amazing woman. She became the Yawanawa tribe in themselves have a really interesting story. Like many tribes in South America, were completely decimated by colonialism and missionaries. They went down to around 70 people at one point in time, so they were nearly completely wiped out. They were told it was kind of the work of the devil for them to do their kind of medicine work and their shamanism and speak their language. So for a few decades they stopped their traditions, and then in the last kind of recent years they've really fought to regain their language and their culture and their traditions. And Putani and her sister became the very first female shamans in their community, and have kind of engendered a whole new female leadership within that community. So she's just an amazing woman. Probably the names I mentioned are not the like necessarily super famous ones that are in the book, but there were certainly, and I'm not saying that the ones who are more well known have not also had an impact on me, but those are the ones probably that philosophically stayed with me and speak to me. Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned right at the top of this podcast, you really did do so much heavy lifting for us. And for that reason, I mean, I am definitely, and you can see there are bookmarks in here, I'm going back over sections, because I interview a lot of people and I feel like I'm constantly trying to get together the information I want to be able to be better informed about the world on many different subjects. And what you've done with this is I feel like you really have put together something that is really robust and helpful. So, sorry, that might have sounded quite patronizing. It wasn't meant to.
Nice, thank you.
but it is really helpful. And it does certain sections I had to go over a couple of times, because I just thought, oh, I'm reading it. And if I really take that in, then I will behave differently, or I will be better informed about something else that I have also been thinking about. So I just think it's a really beautiful piece of work that's been really brilliantly curated. So congratulations. And obviously I'll be putting the links to the book in the show notes so that listeners can read it and find out for themselves.
Oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I really appreciate that. And, you know, the data will continue to change. I mean, hopefully this book will stay, you know, useful for a long time to come. But of course, the landscape and the technology is evolving. And I guess more than anything, what I hope the book does is just encourage us to listen to diverse voices, so that as the information changes, we stay open to new information, we stay open to different ideas and opinions. Because I do think there's a danger right now of increasing polarization. And I don't think that's going to help any of us get to where we need to go ultimately.
Agreed. Agreed. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, you too. Have a nice week.
Thank you so much for listening. If you want to get in touch with me, my email is thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. That's an inbox just for you. Please don't be shy about using it. I love hearing from you. You can also DM me on social media. I'm at Emma Guns on Instagram and Twitter. Or if you go to the show notes, you can find a link to join at the closed Facebook group. You just click that link, answer a couple of questions, agree to the forum rules, and you will be welcomed into that group, not just by me, but by thousands of other listeners to this podcast. We're currently over there having some conversations about all sorts of very interesting things, all started by you. So come and join the conversation. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you on the next one.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.